Okay, this is the hour we take your phone calls. So Neil deGrasse Tyson standing by, and we'll come right back to you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Neil, do you expect a change with this administration towards space?
A change? Depends what you mean by change. I mean, he did change things. He said we're not going to the moon, so that's a change. I didn't view that as a positive change. Although, as I said earlier in this broadcast, when I was at the speech, and when he said, let's skip the moon, we've been there already, been there, done that, let other people go to the moon. It sounded really forward-thinking until I sort of thought about the full-up repercussions of it. I think what needs to happen is that the American public needs to compel our leaders to make the changes that would reinvigorate our space ambitions.
That's right.
And thereby reinvigorate the culture and consequently the economy.
Do we know if the moon might be just chocked full of gold and diamonds? I don't know if it's got any carbon up there or not.
Well, the moon has very little iron for an object that size, and that's what led to the impact theory for its formation, where the Earth in its early solar system,
it's a chunk of us, right?
It gets sideswiped by a Mars-sized, what we call planetesimal, a planet not quite fully formed. But if you get sideswiped, then you scoop up the surface material after the heavy material had already gone to the bottom. So Earth had already formed, and the iron, the heavy iron, most of which sank to the bottom, the lighter stuff floats to the top. If you sideswipe Earth, you're going to make a whole other ball out of our crust, and our crust has relatively little iron in it. So the big carrot on the moon is helium-3, which gets deposited into the lunar surface. But helium-3 is a helium atom that's missing a neutron.
So it's
two electrons, one, and you're counting the number of nucleons in the middle.
And there's lots of it there.
There's lots of it there. And it turns out helium-3 is really useful in nuclear fusion reactors. And it could render nuclear fusion to be a much simpler and efficient process. The problem is we don't yet even have a nuclear fusion reactor. I mean, it's wishful thinking, and good to know it's there for us, but to start harvesting it when we still can't even contain. Oh, by the way, we can undergo nuclear fusion on Earth. They're called bombs.
Yeah, so, exactly.
So they're H bombs is what that is. So it's not likely that they're deposits of the heavy precious metals that we find here on Earth, not large deposits of it. And about diamonds, diamond needs temperature and pressure and time.
And carbon.
Pure carbon, that's right. And there's surely carbon on the moon, but I don't know that it's getting the pressure and the temperature. So I wouldn't rule it out.
How about gold?
Gold, again, that's one of the precious heavy metals that would have not been.
So that would have gone down.
It would have gone down to the center of our Earth. What you really want is to dig a tunnel to the center of our Earth. Every heavy metal is hanging out down there. That's why metallic asteroids would be great mining prospects, because what metallic asteroids are planetesimals that where the heavy stuff fell to the middle, and then they got hit again and broke into smithereens. So if you bust up a mini planet after it had already separated its ingredients, you're going to have metallic asteroids representing the core and rocky asteroids representing the mantle and the crust. And so that would be your mix of asteroid properties and varieties orbiting the sun.
You know, the La Crosse campaign, remember when they blasted a little piece of the moon?
Oh, the LCROSS,
That kicked up a little percent of gold.
So that was a fun mission where you dropped a projectile into a darkened crater near the pole and get your cameras ready to watch the plume rise up above the crater rim and be imaged against sunlight. I mean, it was a very carefully conceived mission to take full advantage of our ability to spectrally analyze the plume of this projectile. And that would tell us what was in the bottom of the craters of the moon, of the polar craters. So, when you have very sensitive spectroscopy, you can find all manner of things. But what matters is it there in large enough quantities to be technologically useful or engineeringly useful?
What do you think of the work of Dr. Paul Davies?
He's an intrepid guy. I mean, he gets around. He has some scientifically controversial ideas, but he's a good educator and a great physicist, and so I think he's now. I haven't checked him lately, but I think he's trying to go a little on the edge. Is that right? What's the latest that you've heard of him?
The latest I've heard is that he has published a scientific paper that we should go to the moon to look for alien artifacts.
Well, in fact, not only alien artifacts, we should go to the moon to look for Earth artifacts. If Earth gets hit by an asteroid,
mm-hmm.
and it can cast, if we know that you can do the simulation on a computer, so we know this can happen, that it will cast pieces of the Earth back into space, some of which would land on the moon.
That's right.
So the good thing about a rock on the moon that came from Earth is that if that left Earth and that rock happened to have fossils in it, then you could have really old fossils of life from Earth sitting unperturbed for billions of years
on the moon.
That's right. And so, I mean, if you're going to look for fossils, I don't know why you would expect alien fossils there, but you'd certainly expect Earth fossils.
That could be pretty dramatic. Of course, you know, I'd love to think of the old school that maybe we visited the moon millions of years ago.
You know, that's an interesting question. I seem to remember a science fiction story that imagined a whole other civilized era that went away, and then we had to sort of rise up again from the cave.
Exactly.
That's an interesting point of view, especially...
I can't rule that out.
I'm not going to rule it out either, but since humans can communicate with each other, that's one of the things that strongly distinguish us from other animals on Earth, I find it hard to imagine that you would have a huge civilization that made great advances and that was not communicated to others who then did not go extinct.
And there's no record.
Yeah, no record at all. Now, of course, Pompeii was completely lost.
Right.
Until, what was the year?
Until
18?
We dug it out.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, it was accidentally discovered. And then we said, oh my gosh, here's the lost city of Pompeii. So it's possible to lose things for sure, but we knew Pompeii existed as a city in the Roman Empire, right?
Well, in India, in ancient texts there, they talk about flying machines, Vermanas, and even Robert Oppenheimer, when he helped develop the bomb, cited texts from, you know, Indian Sanskrit that talked about what could have been construed as a nuclear explosion.
Now, what's interesting is, when you look at these old writings of any culture, we're predisposed to, in modern times, because we have a modern sensibility about what exists and what doesn't exist, right? We have technologies and we do. Okay, so we take that sensibility and we read these ancient texts, and what tends to happen is you go and pick out the things that you can interpret from your modern point of view.
True.
So you see this thing, hey, that looks like a mushroom cloud, or that looks like
a helicopter
or a helmet, right? An astronaut helmet, because you already know what these things look like today. But 100 years ago, if you went back and looked at those same documents, how would you interpret it then, right?
Yeah.
You wouldn't interpret it as an astronaut helmet because we didn't have astronauts. You wouldn't interpret it as a bomb because we didn't have bombs that size. You'd interpret it as something else. So I imagine going back at 100-year increments and collecting all the things we think it was in the absence of all the technology we have today. And so that, with that exercise, it's kind of a mental exercise to do that, I don't then put that much credence or disproportionate credence in what I think it is versus what someone 100 years might have thought it was.
You've got to look at an old Egyptian tablet from Abydos. I'd be curious one day to find out what you think of it, Neil. It truly looks like a boat, a helicopter. There's no question the shapes are the same.
Mm-hmm.
And it was done thousands of years ago.
Sure, and then you can ask, though, how about all the things that you don't interpret as something modern,
mm-hmm.
right? What are you doing with that information? I mean, one of the most important things you can do as a scientist or as someone, if you're scientifically literate, is to assess all the other possibilities that are there and then put your interpretation in context. So if there are so many drawings of so many things that you have mean nothing to you, and then you find the one that does mean something to you, you ask, is that significant? Or is this just sort of this random kind of scribbles that it was random to us? It surely wasn't random to the culture. But these scribbles, and who knows, it can still be a mystery what it is. But just because it's a mystery doesn't mean they were visited by intelligent aliens with helmets.
True. Or
it doesn't require that that's true just because you don't know for sure what it is. So the context of what it is they're describing, I think, matters. And when you read all these books about cool stuff in cave drawings and all of this, they don't tend to dwell on all the things that just look absurd or don't make any sense at all. And I want to see the full package of everything they're drawing. And if it's one in a thousand that you've picked out, then you've selected it. You've helped pick something else out and make sense of that. Oh, I can't. Okay, so why overinterpret the one when you can't even interpret the rest?
Yeah,
that's
kind of
how I look at it.
But look at the ABYDOS. Just go to like Google Images, put in Abydos, ABYDOS, and take a look at that. Thing, whatever
which
it is.
Culture is this? This is
it's Egypt.
Egypt, okay.
And
yeah,
it's part of it's in a stone that's been chiseled away.
Mm-hmm.
It's really weird, but I got to get your take on it.
Okay.
All right. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Darius in Toronto, Canada, to get us going on the Skype line. Go ahead, Darius.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure thing.
I would like to ask Neil about whether you've heard of the Black Knight satellite that preceded Sputnik and has this polar orbit around our planet, and whether you knew anything about it. I'll take my
The Black Knight satellite. I have not.
No, I don't know anything about it. Who's launched by whom?
He's gone. Nobody knows, I guess. Maybe it's an ET.
No, I don't know anything about it.
I'll check it out.
And depending on its altitude, there's no way it would still be orbiting now. The atmosphere has its way of cleaning out moving objects through it. I mean, there's the satellites that remain in lower
orbit. All right, here it is. Let me read it. Ready?
Okay, go.
It says, the Black Knight satellite, a mysterious satellite of unknown origin discovered in 1960, which shadowed Sputnik. It is believed to have been of extra... Shadowed Sputnik.
I don't know. What does that phrase mean?
Followed.
Okay, so it came after, not before it. Fine.
Right.
Okay.
It is believed to have been of extraterrestrial origin, signaled back old radio waves from the 20s and 30s before it disappeared. In short, the wave patterns were analyzed by an astronomer, Duncan Lungen, revealing the origin as Epsilon Botis. It's a star system.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's interesting.
Mm.
Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, so
who knows that they come from there?
That's everything we know about space exploration tells us that Sputnik was the first satellite. So just to clarify that. Now for this, it's a mystery. I mean,
I've heard of this before. I didn't hear of the name of it. Like,
what's useful is if more than one person drew the same conclusion that this fellow Lundgren did. In science, the truth is not established by any individual. It's established by the repeated exercise of someone who's skeptical, someone who wants it to be true, someone who's skeptical of it, someone who's indifferent by it, someone who has a different tactic to measure it, someone who has a different tool they just invented. And if you have consistency among all of those analyses, then you can start to assess it to be an actual truth of the world or of the universe. So I don't know what he means that it's tracked something to the star in Bootes. I don't know what that means. If it's orbiting the Earth, what does it mean it's tracking something to the star?
And now it's gone.
Yeah. So there you have it.
There you go. Okay, back to the phones. Let's go to Carlsbad, California. Frank's turn. Go ahead, Frank.
Hi, great show. First of all, on the Russian moon rocket program that you mentioned earlier that you didn't, there actually was a Russian program, and the trouble was their huge Saturn-like booster blew up on the pad. We found that out during the glasnost era. But they actually did have a moon rocket, manned moon rocket program, and it just didn't develop the rocket. It kept blowing up. And the last time it blew up, it actually took out a bunch of officials. It blew up right on the pad.
Always a bad thing.
It sure was. I have a question on the booster rockets that we could develop. We have Atlas and Delta, the updated versions that are more powerful than the originals. And even the Saturn I, which was a very successful rocket, why not, before we develop new rockets, just go back to those and use those as an interim booster system? And then also, one final thing, and I'll listen to your answer off the air. Could every black hole, or at least larger black hole, end in a big bang or a white hole? I'd like to get your answer to that. Thank you.
Okay, some people think. Go ahead.
Two very different questions. So in the first case, the Atlas and Delta rockets are very successful rockets in the arsenal of the American space program, and they launch satellites. They're not what they call man-rated at the moment, and so that requires a whole other layer of technologies and safety parameters fulfilled before they could be brought to bear on launching humans. So, but even doing so, yes, that would get you to low Earth orbit because that's what they're designed to do, given a certain weight of craft. What we really want to do is not only get to low Earth orbit, but go beyond. And so this new architecture is designed to do all of that, to be scalable to then do all of that. So that's that. But the Atlas and Delta, they're great rockets. And, of course, you have SpaceX, there's the Falcon. This is the efforts of, what's the fellow's name again? Elon Musk.
Yeah.
And he's the billionaire who
good
wrote
guy, Brad
PayPal.
Brewster.
And I guess he sold it to Amazon, was it? For a gazillion dollars.
He made some money.
Yeah. And he loves space. It's great to have rich people who like space because then they can do fun.
That's right. That's like Robert Bigelow. He's doing his thing.
Exactly. Isn't that funny that they're attracted to space and not some other thing? These are people who are trying to relive an era.
Richard Branson. Right? Yeah.
Exactly. So to make a fresh architecture for this, I think that's the right decision. My concern is that it's not happening fast enough, right? I don't want to wait till the 2030s. I don't even know if I'll be alive, right? So now about black holes, there's an interesting thing. Hawking radiation, which you might know about, is the evaporation of a black hole where the energy of the gravitational field around a black hole is so high that it spawns particles. Like the E equals MC squared. The E, in this case, is the energy of the gravity. And it takes some of that energy away and spontaneously creates particles. Stephen Hawking discovered this, hence Hawking radiation. But what he noted was that as the black hole evaporates, it evaporates faster and faster and faster. And the very last gasp of a black hole is a gamma ray explosion. Now, it's not a big bang, but it's interesting to think that the rate at which this thing begins to evaporates accelerates, and it accelerates exponentially so that the very last few seconds, it evaporates so violently that the only way you can interpret it is as an explosion. Now, in a rotating black hole, it turns out there's a space-time solution into it, where if you go into a rotating black hole and you dive down through the event horizon, you will see the entire universe that you just came from unfold in front of you, okay? And because your times shift, you live slowly, the universe goes quickly. So you watch the whole universe evolve and die. And in the process, another universe opens up in front of you. And if you can survive the gravity stress on your body, in principle, you can birth yourself into another universe on the other side, but it's not clear whether you would call that a big bang.
Popping out like bubbles, almost. Let's come back in a moment. We'll take final phone calls with Neil deGrasse Tyson, author of Space Chronicles. We'll be right back. On our next Coast to Coast program, we're going to dive into just about everything for a couple hours with an incredible story of psychic energy, power, why do things happen the way they do. And then, of course, we'll have those Friday night into Saturday morning open lines. And when we come back in just a moment, guess what? That's right. We'll take your final phone calls with Neil deGrasse Tyson, Space Chronicles on Coast to Coast AM. Well, first up, let's go to Mark in Buffalo, New York, east of the Rockies. Mark, go ahead. You're on with Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hi, George. Fly Navy.
Hey, love it.
I was an SSN officer in the 80s.
Super.
And my dad worked SDI at the Space Center, at Kennedy Space Center on Brevard County, Florida. Now, here's some quick information for you. You said Epsilon Bootes.
Mm-hmm.
That, the proper name, the star is called Izar. It's a multiple system, 150 light years away, and it's KO2, which means it's an orange, bright giant. That means that star is in an advanced stage. So I wanted to throw it out because you guys were talking about Epsilon Boothby. Yeah.
Okay, thanks for that.
Mm-hmm. No, I just wanted to update that with you. I'm an astronomer.
I love it.
One thing that I have a disagreement with your guest is that he was touting Obama's speech and how great it was and everything. All I can tell you is that there's no manned flight awareness. We haven't launched an American out of the North American continent after Obama got in. And he put a lot of people out of work at the Space Center. There were guys that had mortgages, kids in college. He put a lot of people out of work.
Okay, yeah, I'll
tell you what the plan is. The plan is to go to Mars. And you know why we need to go to Mars? Because it's there. Okay? We have the technology. We have the financial resources. I mean, this guy spends like a drunken sailor anyway. Let's go to Mars.
The drunken sailors never really start with much money, actually. but I was candid about the consequence of him saying we're not going to go to the moon. I said it cost thousands of jobs. That was a very important dimension of my recounting of that speech. When I said it was a great speech, what I mean was the people in the audience listening to him deliver it, it was a very forward-looking, dreamy speech about our future in space. And then the consequence of it is that we lose all these jobs and we don't do it for decades. And so that was a great disappointment on reflecting back on the consequence of that plan. So I was no less critical of it as you are in this phone call. We should go to Mars because it's there for sure. That's what got us out of the cave to begin with. But what going out of the cave didn't cost anybody any money. Going to Mars cost money. And my analysis of the history of conduct of nations, and it's all detailed in the book, by the way. The book got a nice review from the Library Journal, so it should be in libraries in case people don't want to buy it. It should still be available to access. And my read of history tells me that the people who write the checks are not motivated by it's there. They're motivated by the power that they want to maintain or gain. And so the discussion has to be folded into that a geopolitical context to decide what actually gets done and what doesn't.
You know, wouldn't be great if one day we get a news conference and they talk about a resurrected program to do these incredible things, and it's based on your story, your book. That would be great.
That would be kind of interesting. I mean, I did a lot of work on this to see what has motivated people, and that's the word of the day, the word of the evening, motivated people in the past, and on the hope or expectation that similar motivations would, in the present day, would get us to achieve similarly grand goals. So that's the goal, and I think the recipe is in there.
Let's go to Goldsboro, North Carolina. Jeff, it's your turn. Go ahead, Jeff. Good morning.
Hi, George. Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Neil, I have three questions. One is your Nova Science Now show. Are you still doing those shows?
Thank you. I'm on hiatus from that right now so that I can work on Cosmos. And they're waiting for that to finish, and then we talk about me going back to it. Or not, but I'm on hiatus. And so I'm still on their radar, and they're still on mine.
Okay, I love those shows, so I hope you keep doing it.
Thanks for that support. We try to be innovative and make science really fun, but still not compromise the depth of what the meaning of the science is.
Okay. When Newt Gingrich proposed a moon colony, he was universally ridiculed by people on the left, people on the right, people in Republicans, people in Democrats. So I'd like to know what your take is on kind of the environment of even going back to the moon. And my third question is, what benefit or use do you think we'll get out of the International Space Station, the best product or the best use out of the ISS, and should we fund that past 2020?
Okay, these are excellent questions. So Gingrich was quite the brunt of ridicule when he gave his "Let's Go to the Moon" speech in Space Coast, Florida, which is the region where Kennedy Space Center and Cape Canaveral are found. And you're right. The liberal press criticized it as just being crazy. The conservative press that are pro-Gingrich cited it as being visionary. And then the conservative press that supported his opponent, Republican candidates, also said it was kooky. So the only supporters of him were his supporters who were Republican. My view of it is it's not as visionary. as Kennedy saying, let's go to the moon, when we hadn't yet created a vehicle that didn't kill you upon being launched. So to people say it's too visionary, no, it's not. It's less, because he's saying, let's put a moon colony, yet we've already been to the moon. So to start from the position where we've already been to the moon and then have a moon colony in 8 years, that's not crazy. We did something more crazy than that in 1961. What he believes is the motivation that will enable it, my read of that is that it's flawed. He thinks you can just convince some entrepreneurs that this is just the cool thing to do, that they'll all gather around to do it. And you need a more thought-out driver to make that happen than anything that he was thinking about or that he has considered. And I spent whole chapters in this book on describing how to make that happen without appealing to the failed efforts of the past. When people say, it is our destiny, it's in our DNA, it's our nation's calling, it's the charisma of the leaders, none of those reasons are ever why we went into space. And so I didn't have a problem with it, and neither did others who had considered the value of space exploration. And so when I did that, I did that publicly. The liberal press said that I shot down his moon proposal, and the conservative press said that I sympathized with his moon proposal, which meant I landed exactly in the middle.
Do you think there's going to be some event out there, Neil, where government will make a news conference and say, we have to go, we think there could be life there?
Life would be an extraordinary driver to motivate the exploration of another planet. And if we're going to find life, it's likely going to be Mars and not Venus or somewhere else. So I can imagine such a
announcement.
Such an announcement. That'd be great. That'd be a great day. And is that enough to send people? I don't know, because they'll.
It depends on what the announcement is, I guess.
It depends on what the announcement is. If it's aliens waving to us, yeah.
Yeah. Or there's huts there or something.
We'll send the Marines probably first, because that's how humans react to such forces. But the gentleman's third question about the space station, it's a zero-G laboratory. And so you can imagine all manner of experiments you might do to either or commercial.
Pretty expensive, Neil.
Oh, of course it's expensive. Yeah. But the space station was not built to do science. It was built as a geopolitical maneuver to counter what the Russians were doing in the 1980s
with their plans for
their space stations.
Yeah.
And then once you built it, then you sort of back into science excuses for why you have it. So of course it's expensive, but it's an investment that's already there, and since it's already there, might as well do some good science.
Let's go to the Hawaiian Islands, Maui. Tommy, welcome to the show. Hi, Tommy.
Greetings, George. How are you?
Good, thank you.
Two questions, Neil. You seem very intelligent. You just mentioned a few minutes ago that you believe that when a bunch of scientists come together, they agree on something, then you can accept it as truth. Why is it if 500 people that work for the government, work for high people and high power, plus thousands of other people that actually have contact with a UFO, saw a UFO, or been abducted, that it's not real? For you to say that there's, like, we have never been visited by an alien?
No, I never said we've never visited by aliens. I said that the evidence put forth that we've been visited by aliens is not sufficient to convince the standards of evidence for what is typical in a scientific circle. So you just need better evidence. And so plus I said that it's not whether scientists believe that something is true, therefore it's true. It's that when different scientists conduct an experiment and the experiments are consistent every time they do it, even by naysayers as well as different designs and the like, then a truth emerges out of that. And so it's not a matter of what the scientists believe, it's what the evidence of experiments show.
Neil, where are these new scientists coming from? Are they coming from American universities? Are they being born in this country, or are they coming from foreign lands?
Oh, here's one of my great concerns is that, going back to the 80s, the graduate departments in the sciences and engineering in America were rising through 50% foreign nationals, and that was India, China, and Taiwan, and also Europe, Eastern Europe in particular. Those students stayed. These were some of the best students in their hometowns and in their home countries. They would come and they would stay because we had great opportunities for them here. And by the way, that's not a weird concept, all right? Since the beginning of immigration, we greatly valued people who can contribute to our culture and the intellectual strength of our enterprise. In these later years, post-2001 primarily, where we have this sort of xenophobia about foreigners, this isn't the case. And here's something that Gingrich says that isn't retold much, but most people would agree, that what he wants to do is, if someone from another country comes to America and gets a PhD in engineering or science, you hand them the diploma and you hand them a green card right as they walk off the stage.
And don't let them get away.
Don't let them get away, and then they'll want to stay. Problem is, our economy is completely stagnated. And so where are their opportunities for them?
Well, that's true.
It's back where they came from. China's economy is growing 10, 12, 11, 12%.
What has become of all these workers and engineers who have been laid off from the shuttle program?
I don't know what the latest is on them. Now, many of those that were laid off were from the NASA contractors, because a NASA employee is a government employee.
Sure, but I'm sure they got laid off.
Well, no, you can't just lay off a government employee. They get reassigned and things, or you get early retirement.
So they're working at the post office.
So the real cost here is the contractors working for the corporate partners of NASA, so Lockheed Martin and Boeing and Grumman and this sort of thing. And so, yeah, but nonetheless, it's someone who now can't pay their mortgage. By the way, Florida has one of the highest rates of foreclosures.
That's right.
In the country.
That in Nevada.
Oh, I didn't know that about Nevada.
Oh, Nevada's huge.
That's interesting.
Next up, Sun Valley, California. It is Henry's turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Henry.
The show is great. Its eccentricity is greater than one. It's going places.
You know what I mean? Very nice. Hyperbolic orbit. I love it.
All right. Now, I have a question for you. I was former Air Force satellite wideband and telemetry communication. 2007, they started blowing up things up in space. I remember I was at Detachment 1, Georgia. I was shaking cold. DARPA is working on something called the Phoenix Program in order to salvage dead satellites and their parabolic dishes, okay? Which is why I made that eccentricity joke, you know, parabolic?
Yeah.
Okay. They want to chop off the dish, chuck the baseband section, you know, because it's old and obsolete, but the dish should be perfect because, you know, when you cut to the frequency, you cut to the wavelength, that's like an unmutable, future-proof kind of thing. Have you heard about this project?
No, I haven't, but what's the objective?
The idea is to salvage the dishes because the dishes inherently are perfect. They'll never be, they'll never become obsolete. And so then they'll move these dishes to make a future constellation. Thus, you know, you toss out the golden boxes to burn up, but you keep your dish.
What's curious to me, however, and by the way, DARPA, as your listeners surely know, is an arm of the military that does highly speculative research that normally wouldn't get funded by typical peer-reviewed efforts. And so they're high, possibly very high return, but very high risk. And they only fund things that they know are high risk and there's a good chance of not working, just because they know that's the only way you can do something. So it's the best place a crazy idea might ever come true. So in that, but what I'm curious about is, why go through all of that with an already launched satellite when they could just make another one? I don't understand why the drama of repairing a satellite?
No need. No need at all.
I just don't understand it. There must be some other objective going on.
Well, let's go to St. Louis now. Hey, Scott, go ahead.
Hello, Dr. Tyson, it's a pleasure to talk to you. My question is what is your solution for light pollution? I'm an amateur astronomer, and I'm enjoying seeing the dance of Jupiter and Venus right now.
Aren't they great with the moon a few days ago? It was gorgeous.
It was gorgeous. You know, and, you know, the transit of Venus is also this year. But anyway, what is your solution for light pollution throughout the urban centers of our country that prevents us, our naked eye astronomers, from actually going out without having to travel 40 or 50 miles from our urban centers to see astronomical events like the aurora borealis that was kicked up by the flare about a month ago?
Yeah, that's would be one of the great casualties of light pollution. Is aurora borealis has very low surface brightness, and so you need a very dark sky to fully appreciate the dance and the colors. There's a indie film documentary that was recently released. It's called The City Dark. It's all about light pollution and the cost of light pollution on the possible cost on our health, but the definite cost to our access to the universe if you're born and raised in the city. I was interviewed for the film, and I, one of among many people, including whole legions of amateur astronomers and others. So there are people out there who understand your call, our call, and are trying to do something about it, or at least sensitize communities to the value of a dark sky, either near or certainly within the cities themselves. And so, you know, when you fly in an airplane over a city, if you ever see a light, a street light, that street light is illuminating the sky. That's why you can see it. So it's wasted photons. And so the whoever's paying for that electric bill is paying to light up the sky.
That's all right.
So there are laws being introduced to have intelligently capped lights where the light only points down. And then you need less wattage to illuminate the same area. And that will help to clean up the sky. But New York City might be beyond hope, but other cities where they are in a position to control lighting ordinances, like Tucson, Arizona, which is a neighbor of the Kitt Peak National Observatory, they have the most progressive lighting laws ever. And you go there, you fly over to Tucson, you can barely see the lights that are in the streets. And so there's some hope. I think some cities are beyond reach, New York City, Chicago, possibly Houston, and definitely L.A. But there's the rest of the country that might still be able to respond to this.
Super. Neil, where do we get your book, Space Chronicles?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think it's everywhere. You know, Amazon's got it. If you want to sort of read a few paragraphs on it, on my website, you just Google Neil Tyson, and I think the top hit is my website. In the books section, there's a excerpt from it and a discussion, and so you can judge whether it's something that you'd be interested in.
Hey, you're invited back, Neil, anytime you want, okay, my friend?
Well, thank you. Universe is full of mystery.
It sure is.
And you guys focus on the mysteries. That's great.
I love it. Neil, go for it. Thank you so much. Neil deGrasse Tyson, his book, Space Chronicles, great interview. Isn't he? A lot of energy. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, John B. Wells, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.